I'm taping.
So am I. What do you want to know?
Who's trying to buy security systems?
Who cares?
Everybody ought to care. SS is the largest and most powerful corporation of its kind in the world. It has access to more privileged information than any single government. And if in the wrong hands, it could be used to destroy businesses and lives.
I imagine new owners will find it most profitable to continue operations of SS as they have always been.
Then you're confirming the buyout.
I'd be a failure as CEO if I weren't aware that our stock is being acquired.
Yet you have no worries for SS.
SS will survive.
So will the cockroach.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The East India Company and its role in laying the groundwork for world wars, with the author of 9/11 to Armageddon, William Stewart. But that was 300 years ago. What about now? 500,000 announced dead in the war on terror, depending on which way you're looking at it. That is in Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So how many people have to die before the justice system kicks in and some of those criminals responsible get put on trial and maybe go to jail? Also, 100 years, apparently, of the GRU, Russian Military Intelligence. We hear from Mark Galliari, from the Institute for International Affairs in Prague. And the French President Macron, former employee of the banks and the Rothschilds, he says there's going to be a true European army. The purpose? To defend Europe from the nasty invading Russians and also from the other side, from America. European Maritime Safety Agency has privatised a part of itself to be taken over by Israeli firm Elbit Systems Limited, flying its drones up and down the coasts of the European Union for the cost of $70 million. And the Democrats get a big increase in the vote, but the Republicans increase their hold in the Senate. Finally, as I said at the start, what if everything we thought we knew about the world was wrong? Back to the East India Company and its role in laying the groundwork for world wars. That's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. This week we hear a full interview with James Florey from Veterans for Peace. Also, Dr. Livingston, I presume. What was the story of him and how did he come to be the missionary of Africa? Also, RAF historian Sebastian Ritchie talks about the airlift to the Battle of Arnhem. Listen here on BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But let's start with this news about the number of people dying in the war on terror, Martin. I mean, it's pretty horrific, 500,000, but that may be an underestimate.
I think it probably is, because you're only talking about direct deaths. There's all sorts of indirect
and
deaths.
And only three countries.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about Libya, for example, at all.
No, I think we could argue about the numbers, but it's an awful lot of people. Mostly civilians, as we just said in the first hour. Mostly not soldiers at all, just ordinary folk, like in Yemen, who are all starving to death at the minute under British bombs.
So, why?
Why? Because the underlying all of this is, you know, the desire to dominate and greed. The composer Gustav Mahler said, greed and hypocrisy will always lead to war. And so it's proved.
I suppose I'm trying to hint at here is there doesn't seem to be any kind of international law anymore. International order seems to have broken down.
Well, that's because the Western powers, who are supposedly the guarantors of the system, basically abuse their position in every possible way. And we're now in a very dangerous position, actually, where their potential opponents are beginning to lose faith in anything other than main force to defend themselves.
Well, the war on terror seems to really have, it started in 2001, right at the beginning of the 21st century. Seems to have been an attempt to sort of define that century.
Well, of course. I mean, since 9/11, we've been living in this, dystopian future, which has become the present. And of course, this is all. This is underlying all of this is the power structure in the West, because the West is the dominant actor in all of this, and the oligarchy in the West, the oligarchy particularly in the United States of America, basically ought to be adapting to a multipolar world order where, there's going to be not just one lot of countries telling everybody else what to do, but a more dialogue-based structure. They're determined to prevent that by war. So that's why we've been fighting.
But the US surely is going for broke. It's trying to dominate everything.
That's right. Of course it is. They want full-spectrum dominance. They've made it fairly clear, which, no other empire in history has gone for broke in this
surely
way.
Surely the British Empire had a go.
No, they didn't. Yeah, but they didn't try to control Russia. They couldn't control Russia. They did try to control Russia and China, but they eventually got kicked out. In World War One, they got kicked out of Russia, and in World War Two, they got kicked out of China. And as Mao Zedong said, in World War Three, we're going to finish this off. And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that the West is going to win.
Okay, so what about this 100 years of the GRU, which is the Russian Military Intelligence Service? What do you make of that? Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I think you've got a clip here with this person talking about this. I think it's rather bizarre to speak of it as one continuous structure. There have been all sorts of political changes in Russia in that 100 years, and their intelligence services have evolved according to the political situation. The modern Russian intelligence services are not really the Stalinist GRU. They're a different, there's a whole different political situation there now. And of course, even in China, for example, the modern Chinese state is not the state of Mao Zedong in the 1960s. Things change.
GRU stands for something in Russian, I guess, but it's General Directorate of Intelligence.
Yes, and I think they must be referring, I don't know the exact history of this, but the Cheka was founded by Trotsky and Lenin in the beginning of the Russian Revolution as an arm of the state to try and control their opponents, and that evolved into the KGB, which then evolved into the FSB and the GRU, as far as I know. But of course, there's a whole alphabet soup of intelligence agencies in Russia, as there is in most countries. It's not just one outfit. You've got a number of different outfits with different specialisms.
One of the weird things is that several Nazis, certainly one of them was Gestapo Müller, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, and many say also Reinhard Heydrich. These Nazis had actually gone to the Cheka and got information from them or some training from them before the war.
Well, at one stage there was an alliance between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, so at that point the spies on both sides had shared information, the military on both sides shared information and training and so on, and of course from the Russian side that was quite useful because it meant that ultimately they won World War II and saved us all from the Nazis.
What about the flippant comment from, it may be flippant, it may be serious, from the Nazis also, one of them, Joseph Goebbels, was saying that it's a kind of flip of the coin. You could be a Bolshevik or you could be a Nazi. The two are very similar. Just flick the coin and decide which you
Well,
could
I
be.
Mean, in Germany...
Was that a flippant comment?
Well, no, it's not a flippant comment. If you think about Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, there was a lot of discontent because the Treaty of Versailles, the hyperinflation followed by the stock market crash in the US and the Depression, lots of people were very, very upset, and therefore more extreme politics came to the fore, whether Nazi or communist. And the Nazis and the communists had pretty brutal street battles in Germany during that era, and it was pretty much common all over Europe. And I'm afraid that's, you know, many things that are going on now make these comparisons quite scary.
Well, anyway, he popped up on the BBC's World Update programme earlier this week. His name's Mark Galliardi, and he's from the Institute for International Affairs in Prague. It might be worth saying something about these Institutes for International Affairs. There was something that was started after the death of Cecil Rhodes, weren't they?
Well, I mean, is this one in Prague related to the British Royal Institute for International Affairs? I don't know. You tell me. It's based in Prague.
It's built, it's done under a similar model, and it's also funded from business interests within the Czech Republic.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know what the relationship is between
find almost every, well, as far as I know, every one of these Institutes for International Affairs are pretty much on a similar model to here in Britain. We've got something called Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs.
Well, I'm just going to, all right, but you can't just presume that, can you? No doubt the Russians have got something similar, called something similar.
Which is part funded by the BBC, by the way. And basically, companies fund these organisations, and they're, in a way, they're competing with the Foreign Office in this country for over policy. You know,
Well, I mean, I think we need to. Okay, this guy speaks for this organisation. If people want to know what that organisation represents, then they need to investigate that. You can't presume you know. Let's see what he's got to say.
Well, it's certainly, on the whole, a high-quality one. Yes, we make a lot of fun because of the cases that get blown, but let's be honest, most cases, espionage cases, look a bit silly once the details are out there. And it's clear that President Putin himself doesn't have any problem with it. At the recent gala to celebrate its 100th anniversary, he was exceedingly laudatory. Because the GRU is so active at the moment and so aggressive, a lot of the individual cases are going to be done in a hurry or sloppily, and therefore they're going to get burnt. But the point is, the majority of them are not.
So we're not seeing the good ones, because obviously the mission against the UN chemical weapons watchdog in the Netherlands, where they left behind a taxi receipt, you know, showing where they'd come from and all of the rest of it, that looks pretty amateurish.
It does, but you've got to bear in mind that this was only the most recent of a whole series of operations that this particular team had been carrying out. Now, yes, there were some sloppy bits of poor tradecraft there, for example, with having all kinds of information still on the laptop. But this is the point. If you're running so many operations, and the GRU is worldwide, first of all, sometimes you're going to not be using the A-team. You're going to have to use a sort of a wider spread of people. But secondly, what's clear is that the Kremlin doesn't really care about public embarrassment and public exposure. Now, if your boss is saying, look, it doesn't really matter if you get caught, just see what you can get away with, then that's what you'll do.
Let's go back 100 years. Russia was in a civil war.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if one traces back the GRU's antecedents to what was called originally the Registration Directorate, it was absolutely created in the middle of the Bolsheviks' life or death struggle for survival against whites, revolutionaries, local nationalists, and indeed British, French, American, and so forth intervention forces. And I think this is actually really sort of worth noting, because it's not just a piece of history. It helps explain one of the reasons why the GRU has a very gung-ho kind of wartime mentality, is because that's exactly where their roots were.
Trotsky set them up.
Yes, and Trotsky was a man who, on the one hand, he was a brilliant organizer of the initial Red Guard, Red Army, but on the other hand, he was a man who always understood the political dimension of war. And again, this is something that we see today, that the GRU is a war-fighting organization, but is as much a political war-fighting organization as it is sending in the special forces into Crimea or whatever.
Well, I think that's just a boilerplate view from a sinecured academic paid for by the West. I mean, the idea that that it's not actually clear that anything happened in Holland where these people were accused of this, that and the other. There's an awful lot of manipulation by Western intelligence services trying to make the Russians look bad.
Martin, they found them doing some sort of surveillance on the offices of the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog.
Well,
what do you mean nothing happened?
Well, the fact is they could probably do that with their version of GCHQ. So what they were accused of doing is turning up and trying to listen in to what the OPCW was doing by being somewhere about, you know, half a mile away. Now, you don't need to do that, do you? Well, GCHQ doesn't go around the world with people with laptops, does it?
Well, it depends how powerful their Wi-Fi is.
Well, it doesn't.
It's not going to reach to Moscow. No, but
what I would argue is, in actual fact, the GRU is doing what it usually does, as our intelligence services are. But there's a massive campaign to go on about how the Russians are interfering in elections, the Russians are trying to kill people, the Russians are doing this, the Russians are doing that, the Russians fart in lifts. Anything they do is wrong. And of course, it's part of a campaign by the Western intelligence services, funded by the Western oligarchy, to paint the Russians black. Now, of course, the Russians probably are up to some nefarious stuff. Most people are. But of course, it was the Saudi intelligence agencies who are trained by us and work with us who chopped Jamal Khashoggi to bits in the embassy in Istanbul. Those are our allies doing that. The Mukhabarat in Saudi Arabia works very closely with MI6, very closely. They chop people up in embassies.
It's a bit strange, isn't it, the difference in the reaction between the British expulsion of lots of Russian diplomats over the Skripal case, wasn't killed, and there's been no real evidence presented that the Russians did anything there other than these two guys were on holiday nearby, and the Khashoggi case, which is pretty much proven and now admitted as well by the Saudis.
Well, that just goes to show how completely partisan this whole stuff is. An objective analysis of what different intelligence services are up to is one thing, but don't forget you've got people who are paid a good salary to come out with a load of rubbish in order to keep their salary and to do what their paymasters want them to say. And that's what I think your fella in Prague's all about. He's probably also got plenty of friends in MI6 who brief him.
Also, this week, easy to forget these things, but it was the final kicking in of the sanctions against Iran from the United States. Now, the way that the US has played this, Martin, is a bit of a blinder, really, because anybody in Europe that decides they do want to trade with Iran is going to get sanctions from the United States too.
Yep, it's provocative beyond belief, since everybody else agrees that they've been sticking by what they agreed to do. But the Americans are just saying, well, we can do whatever we like, and if you don't agree with us, that's just too bad. We're going to jump on your head.
I mean, I hadn't actually heard anything from President Rouhani on this, because obviously it's a very important international strategic issue. So I thought I'd see if I could dig out some of his comments. Obviously, not in Farsi, but translated here into English by a very capable crew at the English language program Press TV in Tehran.
The United States has reimposed sanctions on Iran, which were lifted under the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement. Washington's move targets Iran's oil exports, shipping, and banks. U.S. President Donald Trump has described the sanctions as the strongest ever against Iran. They took effect 6 months after he withdrew from the nuclear accord known as the JCPOA. Trump said the deal was a very bad one and had failed to stop what he called Iran's wrong behavior. Tehran strongly dismisses Trump's allegations. It says the U.S. withdrawal and the reimposition of sanctions show that Washington cannot be trusted. Other signatories to the JCPOA have all opposed the U.S. move. They stress that they will do all they can to preserve the accord. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has slammed the restoration of U.S. sanctions, pledging that Tehran will defeat them.
We will proudly defeat the sanctions. These sanctions are cruel, they are against the law, against the agreements, and against UN resolutions. All countries should do the same. According to UN Resolution 2231, all countries should stand up against the United States.
Rouhani said the U.S. sanctions are targeting the Iranian people and not the government. He said Washington is now more isolated than ever, noting that European governments and companies are furious at U.S. policies. The Iranian president also called for unity among the Iranian people and vowed that the nation will never be weakened in the face of U.S. sanctions.
Well, obviously, the Iranians are not very happy about being sanctioned, but they recognise that they've got to develop a siege economy, effectively, and they're taking steps to, you know, export their oil. There's some threats have been made that if they can't export their oil, then they're going to hit the Saudis and prevent them from exporting their oil. Yeah, if the Saudis prevent the Iranians exporting their oil, then the quid pro quos are going to, and that of course is going to push the oil price up, which will then crash the world economy, and off we go towards World War III. Yippee, here we come.
What about the possibility that Iran actually will be able to survive these sanctions? I mean, he's saying basically we're going to be fine, and we're going to actually be able to hit
they're not going to be. They're obviously not happy. It's going to cause all kinds of problems for them. But they're not going to give in just because some bully says you're going to do this and you're going to do that.
I mean,
or else
we're
going to hit
you. Interesting aspects of this is it's not really been talked so much about as economic warfare, which is what it is. But it also is going to cause problems, potentially civil unrest within Iran if conditions get worse there. People are going to start getting annoyed with their government, and then of course we will see the West saying, "Oh look, all these Iranians are rising up." Now, actually, it may well be that the US sanctions are the root cause of that.
Well, that's exactly what the sanctions are designed to do. They're designed to make miserable the life of the Iranian population, so they will rise up and get rid of the government that the West doesn't like and the Israelis don't like, and then they can impose the regime they want. But of course, Iran has got a very strong political culture. It's the most democratic country in the Middle East by a long way, far more democratic than Saudi Arabia. And if they think that they can push the Iranian population into rebellion, they're probably deluded, frankly. They're deluded. There may be some protests about price increases or whatever, but nobody's going to overthrow the regime which they elected. In actual fact, Rouhani is now aligned with Khomeini, so the more conservative and the more liberal factions in the Iranian political elite have now come together, and they're absolutely united in understanding that they cannot deal with somebody like Trump, who they expect will probably get a second term. So they're digging in to fight. And of course, they've got all the advantages. If it really comes to a fight, they've got a proper army, and they've got the geography on their side. Saudi Arabia will be smashed to smithereens before Iran's destroyed.
For many, many years, the Israelis have had a relationship with the Gulf states, which has been more clandestine. Now it's coming more out into the open. And this week, Israel Katz, who's the Israeli I think it's Transport and Intelligence and Security Minister, has been visiting the Gulf states, and his advisor Ariel Shalikar spoke, I think it's actually earlier today, to the BBC. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about this relationship between the Gulf states and Israel.
This trip is one of the trips taking place, which took place just this week, in a ongoing process, I would say, of more and more contact, not only beneath the surface, but sometimes and more often clearly visible, and with pictures even coming out from these visits, something which was not even, we couldn't think about that a decade ago. We believe in Israel that we want normalization in this region. The Middle East, as you know, is a hotspot of problems between everyone and everything. Kurds, Turks, Alawi, and Sunni, Shiite, West, East, Americans, Iran, Israel, Palestinians. So basically, we want to reach out to our neighbors. We already have peace with Jordan and Egypt. We would love to have peace with the other pragmatic Arab states as well, because we understand that we have common interests. Common interests in trade, in transport, in wealth, medicine, security, all kind of things going on in this modern age, 2019 almost, that we see that there's a lot to work together with, and there's another factor which united us, which is the hegemonical threat posed by Iran during the last 40 years, and which is more and more aggressively positioning itself in the whole region.
So you think you're allied by a common enemy, but these Gulf states always said that they wouldn't talk to Israel until there was an effective Middle East peace process. There isn't one. What's changed?
We believe that we are not in the 90s anymore. Things have changed. Leaders have changed. People understand that we are not the enemy of their countries. Oman understands that Israel is not the problem. Other countries in the region understand that Israel is reaching out because we really mean it, because we really want peace. And they understand that their problem is the Shiite Iranian threat, which is the threat for us, the number one threat as well. And we want peace. We want friendship. We want to reach out because we believe that we have common interests, and with the hope that things will become better in this, region in the earth, which is all the time under fire.
You don't want peace with Iran, do you?
I tell you honestly, I'm Persian Jewish origin. My dream is to one day visit the place my parents were born, which is Tehran. I've never been there. My personal dream is, and I believe many Israelis up to the top level want peace with Iran. The problem is that Iran doesn't seem to like us very much in this region, not because we do something to them or because we threaten them or something, just because they don't want to have us here.
So we have an apparent rapprochement now between Israel and several of the Gulf states. What's the US's role in this?
You know, I can't speak in the name of the U.S., but you know that the U.S. is highly involved too in the region, just like the Russians are and the Chinese are, and some of the European countries as well. So basically everyone is involved, and we hope that our input will turn things into a positive direction. I mean, that I have been myself in Oman. I just returned today to Israel. I'm talking to you from Israel. I've been there for a couple of days. The Omani hosts were perfect. They did everything to make us feel home. This is something I couldn't imagine if you would have asked me 1 year ago.
Well, isn't it interesting that the places he's visiting, none of them have democratic elections? They are, in fact, dictatorships run by ruling families imposed by the West in the first place. So the countries where they do have democratic elections, like Iran, they can't talk to them. Or the Palestinians, for example. They don't. You notice he didn't mention peace with the Palestinians there. They're quite happy to make peace with the murderers of Adnan Khashoggi, for example. Netanyahu's already been out there saying we shouldn't be beat up on Saudi Arabia. We need their cooperation, even if they do kill people. After all, we've killed 2,700 people in the last decade in similar assassinations, because that's, and we've actually got a shared policy. So the Israelis, the British, the Americans and the Saudis want a war in the Middle East. That's why we're talking about this. There's going to be one as well if they carry on down this road, but they won't necessarily win it.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
We do spend quite a lot of time in the Middle East. I think it's time we came a bit closer to home, Martin. A couple of things which is, one is that the European Union is saying, well, at least Macron is saying, and the EU are very much listening, that he wants to have a European army. And Nigel Farage has said, well, they've been lying to us for 50 years. They said they'd never want this. And he's saying, actually, it would reduce Europe's dependence on the United States for defence. They're obviously worried, Macron and people like him, the EU, Merkel, I would imagine as well, that they can't necessarily rely on the United States anymore under Trump. And it looks as if there are kind of trade wars breaking out between the two big power blocks.
It does indeed. I think it'll be very difficult for Macron to get a European army off the ground because, you know, getting the European Union to do anything is quite tricky because you've got 27 member states who've all got their own ideas. So, you know, he can talk about it, but whether it'll happen is another matter. Don't forget, it was the British and the French that destroyed Libya in the first place. Sarkozy and Cameron, who went in mob-handed there, with the Americans just giving sly encouragement. And, of course, if you had a European army, it could do stupid stuff like that. So there's not really much of a positive progressive development, even if it did come about.
What do you make of Macron? Where is he actually coming from? He doesn't really seem to be. He popped up almost out of nowhere, didn't he?
Well, the only reason he got elected is because the people who didn't like Jean-Marie Le Pen voted for him to keep him out. Marine Le Pen.
Like you.
Well, exactly. Lots of people, because that's the way the political system works in France. If you don't want the National Front, you've got to vote for the only other candidate that can beat them. There's a runoff round. It was Macron versus Marine Le Pen. So loads of people voted for Macron to keep Marine Le Pen out, but he hasn't actually got that much support.
What do you make of this whole idea of, well, obviously we know that the EU is concerned about Russia. We've just had these exercises, for example. But what about...
That was NATO, not the EU.
Are they real about... it's all Brussels, isn't it? But are they serious about the idea that they might have to have a counterbalance to the United States? Because that does tend to... put pressure on NATO. Maybe NATO is not as strong as it used to be, particularly since Turkey's kind of disappeared out of the orbit.
Well, I mean, the things are in flux. If you saw what happened last week, there was a meeting in Istanbul about the future of Syria, in which four countries participated: the Turks, the Russians, the Germans, and the French. And what was interesting about who was missing from that meeting was the British and the Americans. And that shows that the kaleidoscope is moving. Trump is in fact, by pushing and being so leery, he's forcing everybody all over the world to think about what can we do to get out from under the Americans' thumb. And, of course, for many years there was complacency about it, but that complacency is gradually dissipating.
What about Britain? Is there any thoughts like that here?
Well, there's thoughts like that in this studio, Tony, but you'll find that lots of people are going about being dominated by Brussels, and isn't it terrible that Brussels tells us what to do, will allow the Israelis and the Americans to tell us to invade countries, and off we go and do it, with all of the consequences.
As for Macron, the Jewish Chronicle yesterday had a shocking headline. Starts with the word shock. Shock as Macron announces French Nazi collaborator Marshal Petain is to be honoured. Today, in the Jewish Chronicle again, Emmanuel Macron's office backpedals plans to honour Vichy France President Marshal Petain. So who was Marshal Petain, and was he some sort of Nazi collaborator, I imagine?
Well, he was actually the general in charge at the Battle of Verdun, which made him very, very, you know, it made him very, very famous in France. I wouldn't necessarily say popular, but he was famous and he was regarded as a senior figure.
Well, tell us a bit about that battle then.
Well, it was one of the bloodiest battles of World War I, in which the French army was basically minced up by the Germans. There was actually a big mutiny in the front line
by the French. Why is Emmanuel Macron saying on Wednesday this week that this Nazi collaborator was a great soldier?
Because at that stage he was regarded as a great soldier, because he was the victor of Verdun. In fact, nobody won the Battle of Verdun. It was a horrible draw in which both sides were bled to death. The Falkenhayn, who led the German forces, he killed loads and loads of French soldiers. But then, of course, his own soldiers also got mashed to bits. So it was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, quite literally. But Petain had in the 30s was regarded as a patriotic French leader and so on. But of course, that was then parlayed into him setting up the Vichy government and collaborating with the Germans in all sorts of ways to help their war effort, including killing lots of Jews. And therefore, there's a very good film about all of this, La Tristesse et la Pitié, the Sadness and the Pity, which was made in 1968, about the collaboration in France. And it wasn't shown in France until the 1970s because people were too scared to look at the truth of what went on.
Amazing. Just trying to go to the website. It was there earlier on today, but it's disappeared now. All you get is an error message if you go to the headline saying shock as Macron announces French Nazi collaborator Marshal Petain to be honoured. But the Jewish Chronicle have put up another article which is saying... Is saying the same, but I suppose it's been revised or something. Macron said that the leader of the Vichy France puppet state during the Second World War was a great soldier. But so there is still something there. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But that's pretty shocking. Who is this guy Macron? Let's go back to that one again. Why is he saying things like this?
Well, what he's doing is he's blundering around as a mainstream politician. He wants to strike the right note because we're remembering the end of the First World War. So he wants to strike the right note. And of course, at the end of the First World War, Petain was a hero.
Martin, this guy was responsible for the deportation of thousands of Jews from France.
Yeah, so Macron basically is being a bit silly by trying to say...
Is it that he just doesn't know his history?
Well, either he doesn't know it or he hasn't thought through the consequences of what he's saying. It's foot in mouth time. And I think there's lots of this going on about World War One, everybody going how wonderful World War One was, and wasn't it great that we won it, etc., etc. And there's a temptation for politicians to just jump, believe their own propaganda about this, and then jump in with both feet, forgetting that in actual fact, all that World War One did is set up World War Two, and all that World War Two seemed to have done is set up World War Three, and we're on the verge of it as we speak. And people might think that's an exaggeration. That's certainly not how the Russian and Chinese general staffs are looking at it, or the Iranian general staff. They are preparing, as a Russian diplomat said the other day, we are preparing for war. The West is preparing for a war. So, but he said, I want to distinguish between those two things. We're preparing for war, but the West is preparing for a war. The West is preparing to fight, but we're preparing. We don't want a war, but we're preparing because we've got to. That's where we've got to in this day and age, on the anniversary, 100th anniversary of the armistice.
This company, Elbit Systems Limited, has been awarded a contract to supply these drones for the European Maritime Safety Agency. Why are Brussels awarding these sorts of contracts to an Israeli firm? I mean, surely there is somebody, you know, some companies within Europe that could do this. And actually, surely it should be being done by the government. This is a government job, a surveillance of the coastline, isn't it?
Well, one of the problems we've got is because the Israelis have become the experts on counter-terrorism, that whenever you try to set up a security structure, well, we're the experts. And then, of course, if you outsource it, they then bid for the contracts and they get them. So ICTS, the Mossad link company, ran all three airports on 9/11 and still runs Schiphol in Amsterdam. And of course, if you run all of these security agencies, like the London Underground TV is run by Verint Systems, isn't it? Which again is an Israeli linked company. Most people don't realise that when you outsource...
Well, I'm not sure they've still got the contract.
Well, I mean, the point is, if you outsource this kind of thing, then people can bid for the contracts who actually haven't got the... are not committed to your political structure.
And they don't care whether your people live or die.
No, and in actual fact, that's a lot of the false flag terrorism is then easily facilitated. Like Schiphol allowed both the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber onto the plane without checking them properly.
So
we've got eyewitnesses saying that happened.
So Brussels thinks it's getting a bargain for only £90 million, this contract, but actually there could be other people paying this company in order to,
the Israelis are looking for lost leaders. Yeah. So they basically, because they spend an awful lot of US taxpayers' money on defence and you know, hacking and all the rest of it, they're then in a very strong position to bid for contracts as they're privatised. Now, of course, I would argue that all military contracts should be run in-house for security
reasons. To be fair,
this isn't
military, is it?
Coast Guard is fundamentally a military. If you think about all of the you know, refugees that are flooding across the Mediterranean at the minute, is it really a good idea to have Israeli drones checking on all of that on behalf of the European Union? I would suggest not.
Well, you've been talking about war quite a lot, and we did hear from David Livingstone last week, Martin, but one of the clips we didn't have time to play was where he talks about, he's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. He's just got a new book out called Ordo Ab Chao, and he's really looking at the way that society has been manipulated for years from behind the scenes in many ways, and that we get occasions, short periods of time, where we've got some kind of democracy where the ordinary people get a say in the way things are run. But he's pretty cynical about where we are with that today, and he uses Trump as an example of one of the people who's been put in power really by the deep state, that we're not getting a lot of choice over who we are voting for. Maybe the choice between two maniacs is not really much of a choice at all. So let's hear what he's got to say now about some of the people who are behind much of the shenanigans, terrorism. And he talks here about something called anarcho-capitalism. And that is to say, people who want to make money but aren't interested in obeying the law, and also a group called Le Cercle, which he sees as part of the fascist international. We often hear, don't we, about nationalistic fascism, but not so much about the international fascism.
We don't need to name them the Illuminati in our time, but there's enough evidence. In fact, it seems like one of the more powerful groups in our time has been Le Cercle, or the Cercle Pinay, and that's founded by a couple of Bilderbergers and has really been the parent organization behind much of the fascist international. I mean, a well-known anarcho-capitalist would be Murray Rothbard, and he's really one of the godfathers of the modern libertarian movement. What's interesting there is that he developed with his partner Lou Rockwell, who used to write for Ron Paul, by the way, they developed what they call an outreach to rednecks strategy, which was basically to appeal to racist sentiments in the U.S. as a Trojan horse to carry forward their neoliberal ideology, or what they call anarcho-capitalist. These groups and thinkers are very closely aligned to the leading transhumanists, particularly a person like Robert Anton Wilson, who's very much the godfather of transhumanism, particularly for his role in the popularization of a very strange tradition called Discordianism. So my latest book, really, it kind of wraps up all these trends that I've been following. You have the very close relationship between fascism, transhumanism, and Discordianism. And So Discordianism is what it sounds like. It's a belief that life is chaos. It devolves out of chaos in the belief in chaos magic. And chaos magic is really the modern form of occultism today. We've really seen it play out in the election of Donald Trump with the creation of fake news, popularized by various online communities, particularly 4chan, which is basically populated by Discordians. And so it's what they call mimetic warfare. It's based on their agenda of rocking the boat, of deliberately confronting what they call political correctness by being deliberately offensive, by inciting hatreds and prejudices, is all part of what is basically their form of magic, and which is basically is chaos magic, which is ultimately tied to esoteric fascism. And that's the times that we're heading in these days.
Mimetic warfare, Martin. There's lots and lots of terms he's using, some I wouldn't use personally, but mimetic warfare, this is like the idea of getting a thought, an idea, and sending it out there because it's going to have some kind of political effect, even if it's a negative effect.
Well, it's just what used to be called psychological warfare. He's just using jargon there. I think his characterization of Murray Rothbard and others as esoteric fascists is a bit, it's just a bit extreme from my point of view. Libertarians, for all of their faults, Murray Rothbard famously said war is the health of the state, and they tend to be very, very anti-war, the kind of people he's mentioning, like Ron Paul, for example. I don't agree with Ron Paul. He doesn't believe in nationalised healthcare.
But he wasn't mentioning Ron Paul there, was he?
No, he mentioned the guy working for Ron Paul, the other, we're talking about the American libertarian right. Now, the American libertarian right, I'm not of the libertarian right, but the idea that these people are esoteric fascists, I think is a bit overdone, because in actual fact, they tend to be the people who vote against wars in foreign countries, like Justin Raimondo, who runs the antiwar.com website, which is a very good source of information, even though his politics are completely different to mine. And I think the idea that these people are fascists, I think is just overdone. They're not. They're dangerous in various ways, but they're not fascists.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Now we go on to William Stewart now. He's the author of a book, 9/11 to Armageddon, Bankers Make Wars, which seems pretty clear. Nowadays, it does look as if the banks are very much behind the arms industry, that a lot of political lobbying that's leads to war. And also, they benefit from war as well, not only in the grabbing of resources for the big companies that they own the stock in and that they've invested in over the years. There's all sorts of reasons. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to an extract from a talk that he's done, William Stewart, based around his book. And this is going right back sort of quite early, really, to look at the role of the Lombard Bank.
It goes back to 697, when a central bank was created in Venice with various agents attached to it. And what we do know is that over hundreds of years, this bank arranged a variety of different wars, as well as the sort of slaving and currency manipulation and so forth. And we do find them at work in the Eastern Mediterranean from that early date, eventually spreading through into Europe. And it's a central bank which hides itself in what we call Red Masonry or Templar Lodges. The reason they're called Templar Lodges is because this organization took over the Templars in 1099 and turned them into the occultists that they became. So what we've got is this movement from Venice into the Eastern Mediterranean, then slowly up into Europe. The organization is really a central bank which likes to cause our wars. And that is done for two reasons. First of all, for profit, to making money, arms, supplies and so forth to both sides. And secondly, to make conquest of lands and governments and to exploit them once they have fallen.
So what we're talking about is a group of people who are basically asset stripping and working to a particular structure.
Yes, they are. They plan what they're going to do 120 years before they act. So for that reason, it's extremely difficult to find out who did things. And when you begin to get on the trail, the people responsible are already dead. And they work really through the grandson. So it's probably grandfather who does the planning. And then you get the various workings up to the event. And it's the grandson who triggers the event. I've got numerous instances of this, and it surprised me as much as it will surprise your listeners. It appears in Fama Fraternitatis, which is one of their secret documents, and it mentions that in 120 years a door will open, and you do get it first of all in there. What it represents is the time when these bankers, you call them Lombards, Italian bankers, the time when they were driven out of Europe and driven out of Britain for bankrupting it, and they spent, roughly speaking, 120 years in exile, being kept contained in Venice. There have been a number of wars, right the way going back in history, of course, and the 30 Years' War was one of theirs. But I want to bring it right up to the present, or let us say the 1700s, and just begin there, because that's when the strategic wars start, and it's the moment when the central bank in Venice sent out an agent, a main agent, who was part of the family bank called Antonio Conti. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what Conti arranged. We're going back into 1700s, and history does not cover any of this, and history will have another version, but I can't help that. This is simply part of my research and what I have found out. Now, in 1730, Conti, Agent Conti, opened the Boston Lodges. He did so in conjunction with Isaac Newton, who was working inside the Bank of England, who was the Grand Master of Zion, or of the Templars, and foreign shareholders in the bank. Bank of England, that is, joined in to assist this process. Now, the Bank of England at that time, which of course is now a reformed bank, but at that time it had been founded by the Lombards and was working in link with Geneva, which was again a center for all this, and Geneva was working in link with Venice. So their agent arrived in Britain, and one of the things he did in 1730 was to open these Templar lodges. These are the lodges that set off the American War of Independence, which is their first strategic war. And they did so in conjunction with banking. Then we move to actually a little bit before that in 1713, and Conti was at work in France, founding all kinds of secret lodges there. One of these lodges trained Voltaire, and Voltaire was to meet with both Conti and Benjamin Franklin, who helped to set off the American War of Independence, in the Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris. And this was one of the major sort of espionage bases for the Lombard process. So we can trace what became the French Revolution straight back to Conti and to the Nine Sisters Lodge of Paris. Later on, the French Revolution was set off by Lord Shelburne, and there are still documents in the British Museum to show this, and he triggered the French Revolution, which was going to be Seal II or War II. As I say, the fiery letters of Shelburne and his assistants stoking up revolution are in the British Museum. Now, Lord Shelburne, again the 1700s, was the chairman of what is called the East India Company, which of course is part of Lombard control. The whole company belonged to them. So now we have some, you know, very solid and suspicious facts around the French Revolution. Then in 1740, I think it's about 1740 to about 1750, the de Saussure family, who came from Frontenac's castle in Geneva, moved to South Carolina, and they were actually agents of this whole process at that time. So what you find is that the family settles in South Carolina, and it's the Daniel, the grandson of the family, who kept in contact, constant contact with Frontenac's castle. It is he who helped to trigger and steer the American Civil War. Now we've got another agent who's called Mazzini, always worked in the 1800s, following Conti in the 1700s, and Mazzini went over to America and worked at presidential level to make sure that the Civil War, American Civil War, occurred. Well, you know, that was a war of great butchery with the Astors on one side, the Rothschilds on the other, and both of these two founded the Round Table. From Russia, which again is going to be our third war, we discover that the East India Company's secret society, which is called Fratres Lucis, was operating in Russia in the 1700s. So although we can't exactly have the same process and say this agent did that, both Conti and Mazzini and their agents were at work in Russia. Throughout the 1800s, Mazzini put his agents into Russia, somebody called Pappas, who was an agent, and the agent of Martinism and Synarchy, which is basically the right wing dominating the left wing process. And so we know that it was all there. But what happened in that particular war, which helped me to put, you know, my pictures together, was that the Russian Revolution actually began to fail because the peasants remained, and the people remained, loyal to the Tsar. And so what had to happen was there had to be some direct intervention.
Martin, a lot of that is unreferenced. A lot of it is speculative, but there's some interesting threads running through it. And particularly what he's suggesting there, and it's something that I find quite appealing, is that actually it only takes a tiny number of people really to create these wars. So long as they can do it in secrecy with some kind of cover over the top of it, it's actually not that difficult to do.
Well, wars, I'm afraid, are 10 a penny. In actual fact, throughout most of human history, war has been the norm rather than peace. And therefore, you don't really need much of an explanation to explain why wars happen. That's what people do. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't trying to manipulate the wars for their own purposes. And, as Machiavelli pointed out years ago, we've all got the desire for more, and the pie is always going to be finite. So there's always going to be a struggle over who gets what bit of it.
Okay, this-
And, of course, there'll be different ways in which various people are fighting their corner. And, of course, I find a lot of that rather tendentious, actually. As you said, history will tell a different story, but my research shows otherwise. Well, I would say that all historians, not all of them are of good intention, but there is a peer review process. And, in actual fact, there's an awful lot of research done into all of these things, more research every year. And the idea that it can all be explained by one explanation is basically
a bit
reductionistic.
Look, he's not saying he's the only person. He's just saying that lots of stuff is coming to light nowadays, which hasn't for a while. And also, he's basically saying that he's giving the George Orwell view, isn't he? He who controls the present controls the past. And that some of history is spoon-fed to us, like the kings and queens. And maybe there's other stories out there that are worthy to look at. Anyway, let's have a look now at the Ottoman Empire and its relationship to the First World War.
World War One was started in 1711. And what happened was an agent of the British East India Company went over to Saudi Arabia and founded what became the Muslim Brotherhood. He also founded occult lodges all over the Middle East. So this Muslim Brotherhood arose in power when they wanted it to, which was to cause World War One by breaking up the Ottoman Empire. And that Ottoman Empire was being manhandled and manipulated anyway by the said bankers. So we can account for World War One. We can account for World War II, we can produce the data on it, and we can say that the same lodges, the same bankers, the same central bank, the same sort of industrial military complex were involved in the seven strategic wars. What World War II brought us, of course, was the European Union, and the bankers who created the European Union are the same bankers who planned Nazism and communism in 120 to 140 Broadway, New York. And the funding was coming again from the bankers. As I said, it's 120 to 140 Broadway, which is a group of the six bankers operating from New York. The important point to recognize there is that these bankers are more or less controlled. I don't think they own the money that they so lavishly spend. And they are linked through into the round table groups in Britain and to the round table groups across Europe and into Switzerland. So there's a big group of bankers, European, Russian, German, British and American, who know perfectly well what they have done. So there was a swill of money, and then also supplies of armaments and ammunition. And indeed, Rockefeller Standard Oil supplied oil to the Third Reich all the way through the Second World War. So there's quite a lot to look at there. What you end up with is being quite certain that money was behind the whole process, and when they got rid of Hitler and the Nuremberg trials erased the rest of them, you still had the bankers who did the paying, who did the planning as of the 1700s, still intact, still there, untouched and much, much richer.
And basically they went scot-free?
They went completely scot-free. They must have known then, I think, some people, but we know who they are, and they got away with it completely, yes. And when the shutters come down and the secrecy starts, of course, that generation, we're talking of the three generations now, or 120 years, that generation's already dead. And so all the links go back to them and then seem to be lost. We've got war number seven to come, and we can just remind ourselves of how that starts. It'll start 120 years before it happens. So if you take a strategic date like 9/11, then you count back 120 years and you end up with 1881. And what I'd like to do now is very briefly, and I know this is all a bit complicated, but we're going to look very briefly at 1881.
Well, what was significant about 1881?
Right, well, first of all, I want to just talk about a little link between 9/11 and 1881. So I'm going to talk about September the 11th. Why September the 11th? Why did that occur in the United States of America twice? The first time was when 11 states in America tried to kick the Red Lodges or the Templar Lodges and the bankers out of America altogether. And this group of anti-Masons, as they called them, but of course it wasn't Freemasonry, it was Red Masonry, they met each September 11th for at least 10 years and tried to remove the Lombards and the Red Lodges from America. You've got to remember that at the same time, you think of the connections, the Muslim Brotherhood, which belonged to the bankers, had been set up in the Middle East. So there's a little sort of sideways link. And we can start this 1881 with the fact that the Red Masons and their bankers murdered a Mr. Morgan around 1830. He was one of the leaders of anti-Masonry. And very curiously, his body was discovered in 1881. So you get a kind of jolt whereby it's almost as if somebody's saying to America, I'm warning you, that was our judgment and there's more to come. The Lombards, Red Lodges, judge humanity, thinking themselves to be John of Patmos. And I can produce the degrees which show that that is the case. So they're really judging America, I believe, for September the 11th and the attempts to get rid of them and to remove their banking system and all the problems that they had caused. 1881 was when the bankers, who had been kicked out of Britain, incidentally, in 1874 with the closure of the East India Company, returned to Britain. This nasty group, which became Round Table, came back to Britain. It came through to create the Fabian Society, Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, formed first of all by the German Rothschilds, Astors and Bate. And the Round Table turned out to be a war-making organization, of course, because we see where it came from. It came from the bankers. And it set off the Boer War and the Russian Revolution. It spread into America as a splinter of Round Table called the CIA, not the main CIA, but a splinter of it, the Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg, and Trilateral Commission, which currently fall to the Rockefellers, but to the bankers. So you've got forming a cell in America, a cell in Britain, which is called Round Table. And this all came from the 1881 return of the Lombards to Britain through something called the Sidgwick Group, which then morphed into the Round Table groups. Today, the links between these two groups are called BAP, the British American Project, and you'll find at one end is the Round Table in Britain, at the other end is the Round Table in America, and the British one links into the European Union. So you've got this not a government organisation, very rich, very powerful, a horrible background, which is operating today.
Well, his book is called The Invisible College, 9/11 to Armageddon. And Martin, he believes that what we were hearing about earlier, actually, the tension between Israel and Iran is being deliberately set up in order to create a war.
Well, I think there is a deliberate intention to create a war. The question is this rather tendentious explanation of how it's come about to be taken seriously? I'm willing to listen to what people have got to say, but what generally happens in history is things are overdetermined. There's more than one factor at work, and things get pushed around in all sorts of different directions. And, for example, the Cultural Revolution in China, a big event, killed millions of people. Was that the bankers as well, or was that just communist nutcases?
Good question. Right, well, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Coming up live on Facebook, we hope, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem leader and councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon on BCFM 93.2 or online now at dialectradio.co.uk. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk, and I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Inshallah. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.